Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money for another beautiful Monday in Park City, and expecting a high of 61 today under sunny skies, and add 10 more degrees and a little breeze tomorrow, high of 71 and a little breezy. So a couple of nice days, and then of course, Doug, the rain returns. This is Larry Warren along with
the
Doug
rain
Wells.
And maybe snow.
And a little hint of that I hear up at the top of the Tour de Suds course and at the top of the Uintas. So, well, I guess summer did end officially the day before. So, but we're supposed to have fall in between, so that'll be coming. Well, let's move on. The show should be interesting today. A couple of local businesses, state businesses, and a kind of a provocative book that turns conventional wisdom of cutthroat businesses being highly successful businesses on its head. We're going to start with a conversation with Peter Shankman, who's on the line with us. He's the author of Nice Companies Finish First, Why Cutthroat Management is Over and Collaboration is In. So we'll talk about successful companies that you want to work for and you want to do business with, and how well they do as opposed to some others that have had tyrannical leaders.
Yeah, we don't want any of that. Larry, our second guest is going to be Jessica McCleary, the owner of Moundtown Olive Oil. They have two locations, one on Lower Main Street, the other in the Gateway. Many of us have probably gone in there. You can taste the olive oil. You can taste the balsamic vinegars. So she's going to be our second guest.
You know, and Jessica was on Mountain Money on an early edition, and I wondered how in the world can a company survive that just sells olive oil.
Well, we're gonna find out.
And it not only survives, it thrives. It's expanded.
I have wondered the same thing, so I'm interested in talking to her about that. And then our final guest is going to be Norm Nelson. He's with Vivint.com. Vivint is one of the larger players in the home security space, and they had a very nice exit. Last November, they sold Vivint for $2 billion to Blackstone, which is a private equity group. So we're going to talk with Norm Nelson.
And that's Utah homegrown company.
Absolutely, and local investors as well, which is great to see. So it should be a fascinating morning, interesting conversations. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. We're talking now with Peter Shankman. Peter, are you there?
I am indeed. Good morning.
Okay, very fine. You've spent some time in the world of public relations, marketing, and branding, and writing books about those subjects. And the new book, Nice Companies Finished First. Tell us about the idea behind the book. The thesis clearly is that this is the way to go in the future.
Well, it's true. I mean, I had a company that I was running for about 4 years called Help a Reporter, and it was a social media network that connected journalists with sources. When it was acquired for a pretty decent amount. I was kind of shocked by it. And when I tried to do the homework and figure out why, I realized it was because for the 4 years I'd been running it, anyone who used my service could email me directly, and I would respond personally. And it was really people felt tremendously loyal to sort of what I had built, and they became evangelists for what I'd built. And I never spent a penny on advertising. My customers really did my marketing for me. And so after I sold the company, I started doing some research into other companies that focused more on the customer as opposed to, say, the bottom line, or as opposed to, say, pleasing the stockholder. And the results were actually really surprising, and then again, not so surprising. We realized that companies that focus on treating their customers well, treating their employees well, treating the environment well, things of that nature, have anywhere from a 20 to 40% higher revenue over the life cycle of their company than companies that sort of subscribe to the the 1980s sort of Gordon Gekko eat your young mentality.
Ouch.
And we were really amazed by that. And so the book really talks about multiple companies who do that, who treat their customers well. And, you know, the basic takeaway is this. We live in a society now where there is no privacy anymore. Anything you do is public. Anything that happens for good or for bad, you know, will be tweeted, will be Facebooked. The revolution will, forget about being televised, the revolution will be shown on a social network. And if everyone, you know, find me one person in your world who doesn't have a camera in their cell phone. And so if everything has the ability to be shared, the simple act of treating a customer essentially one level above crap, we expect to be treated very, very poorly. So you don't even have to go out of your way to be amazing. Just be one level above what we expect, which is typically crap. Think about your last airline flight or your last hotel flight or your last hotel trip. So if you can treat them one level above that, they will become fans. If you go two levels above that, they'll become super fans. Super fans, regular fans bring come back to your business. Super fans bring 15 of their friends.
You know, there's a lot of truth to that. I do not like traveling. I think most Americans feel the same way. But I am a fan of Southwest Airlines. And, you know, it's still an unpleasant experience even on Southwest Airlines, but it is just a little bit better. And you do feel like they listen to you when you have an issue.
Well, that's the amazing thing. You know, airlines, in terms of customer service, airlines, cell phone carriers, and insurance companies are consistently ranked as the worst. And so what's really amazing about that, you know, you get to an airport, right? You've had a horrible experience with the TSA. They've touched you in places that, you know, you really don't want a random man who was working at 7-Eleven 2 weeks ago to be touching you. You get through that whole experience, hopefully with your clothes still on, and then to be told, sorry, the flight's late, nothing we can do, go deal with it. You know, tell me something simple. We get it. There's weather. Weather happens. We understand that. There's snow. We get that. You know what? Give me a $5 coupon to go get a drink. Or, you know, just do something to show
empathy.
Me that you're human. Exactly. You don't have to You don't have to take out a whole new plane for me. I'm happy to wait, but show me that I'm a little more than cargo to you. And that's all it takes. And I have, in the book, case study after case study after case study of these little tiny moves that are propelling, you know, businesses big and small to tremendously increase revenues. And look, at the end of the day, I'm a nice person. I think that being nice is a good thing. But let's be realistic. I also live in New York City, and I'm a big fan of money.
Yeah,
being nice, you win on both counts.
Yeah, you know, the airline example, in the book, you profile several people who do it right. And one is a Utahn I've known since he was a teenager, I think, Dave Neilman. And he built Morris Air on those principles of Southwest and wound up selling to his airline to Southwest and then founding JetBlue. What did you find admirable about Dave?
You know, one of the things I really like about it, first of all, Dave, much like me, is a professed fan of his ADD. We both have massive ADHD, and we both believe that we use it tremendously to our advantage. So that's sort of a bonus. I feel like a kindred spiritship with him, number one. But more importantly than that, what I really liked was Dave, everything he says, you can believe. You know, the chances of him using corporate speak or lying to you to make a buck are very, very minimal. And, you know, you look at some of the bigger players in the airspace, they'll tell you whatever they believe the stockholder wants to hear. One of my favorite examples of Dave Neilman, when JetBlue was just a few years old, there was a massive snowstorm in New York. Every other airline canceled their flights. JetBlue said, you know what, we're going to fly anyway. We're going to get passengers there. Well, of course, the airline shut down, and JetBlue, because he didn't stop the planes at the right places, it took JetBlue something like a week to get back into, you know, had to cancel a ton more flights than if he canceled the original. He came out and said, you know what? We screwed up, and we're learning, and we're going to take from it, and we're not going to make this mistake again. That, to me, right there, you know, took care of the entire problem. A CEO comes out and admits when he screws up. The concept of transparency is huge. And for him to come out and say, you know what? Buck stops with me. That was my fault. Not going to happen again. I respect that much more than a CEO who says, oh, we don't know why it happened.
And, you know, I think part of the respect I have for David with that is he did come forth and say, not only did we make a mistake, but I made a mistake personally.
Exactly.
I made that call. And ultimately, as you know, it led to him being relieved as CEO of the company. So there were big consequences to him, but he still did what he believed to be the right thing.
And he did not only that, but, you know, it's not like when you leave a company, you're suddenly out for the rest of your life. I would follow him into his next company. I'd hire him. I'd work with him. He showed his character. And yes, sometimes you have to fall on your sword, but he showed his character. And to me, that's a lot more important.
Yeah, it's a good point. He's doing an airline down South America that I understand is quite successful.
In Brazil. Yep. Yes.
Yep.
So talk about nine traits that these good companies possess. And let's go through some of them. I think we've talked about customer service, but let's talk about a few others, like accessibility. What do you mean by that companies need to be accessible to their customers?
Companies and people in those companies need to be accessible to their customers, to their shareholders, to their employees. You know, I have on my personal website, on Shankman.com, which runs my entire life and my business and all the different things I have a hand in, you know, I list my calendar on there because I spend a lot of time on the road. I list my calendar. I say, hey, you know what? Here's the cities I'm going to be in, the countries I'm going to be in on these days. If you live in that city, you know, email me. I'll buy you the first cup of coffee. And I'm always willing to take the first meeting. And I've gotten so much business out of being willing to take the first meeting. You know, the phone number on my website is my personal cell phone number. Call me. You know, it's not, don't go through my assistant. Now, that being said, I make my assistant run my assistant actually took away write access to my calendar because I tend to schedule accidental dinners on the same night on separate continents. But other than that, I answer all my own emails, and I let people contact me directly, and I'll always take the first meeting. You know, there's a great, I forget which president it was. I think it might have been Andrew Jackson, who every year put a big block of cheese in the White House and offered it to anyone who was hungry. And once a year, he would have Big Block of Cheese Day, where people who normally would not get the attention of the president or his cabinet could meet with these people to discuss any problem they had. And it was one of the reasons that Andrew Jackson was so beloved. And I believe in that. I believe in the concept of being available. You know, without customers, without employees, without any of that, you have nothing. So to hide in a glass tower or an ivory tower and only listen to your top management or whatever, you know, eliminates 90% of the opportunities you have and only guarantees that you'll be fed more than likely what other people think you want to hear. The best CEOs I know walk the factory floor, get involved. That's why I'm such a fan of Undercover Boss.
Yeah, you know, the bank where I bank on their literature puts the bank president CEO's email on. All the correspondence says, if you have a problem, contact me. And I actually did have a problem once, and I contacted him, and I got an email back in 6 hours saying, we'll take care of it. So
it is mind-blowing because when that happens, you tell the world. I'll never forget, I bought a ticket on United Airlines, or back when they were Continental several years ago, and something happened. I was charged a lot more or whatever, and I couldn't get a response. So I wrote a letter to the CEO. I wrote a letter to his email, and I'm sitting in my apartment an hour and a half later, and my phone rings. I'm like, hello, is this Peter Shankman? Yes, this is him. Please hold for, at the time it was Larry Kellner. Please hold for Larry Kellner, president of Continental Airlines. You should have seen mouth drop. And Larry Kellner gets on the phone. And he says, Mr. Shankman, I understand that you have a problem. And I'm just, you know, all of a sudden, all my anger and all my posturing. Well, yes, sir. I mean, it's certainly not a big deal enough to involve you,
didn't
sir.
Mean to bother you.
Exactly. Peter, that was incredible to me.
Peter, why do you think these stories are so rare? I think the reason both of these stories resonate with people is because the few times they do happen, they make a huge impact on you. Why do you think they're so rare?
I think they're rare for several reasons. The first reason is because we are a country, for some reason, our business practices, we tend to look towards the next quarter and not any further. If you look at other countries, the Japanese, for instance, they'll look at the next quarter century. And they understand that an investment in customer service is something that's going to pay out, you know, 50-fold over time. We are very much determined in our corporate society here, make the shareholders happy, it's the immediate gratification that. In other countries, people understand that delayed gratification is a better gratification system. That's number one. Number two, we're starting to see more companies make the change into better customer service because of the social web that we're in. You know, in the 50s, and this is one of my favorite stories, in the 50s, you know, mothers would get together. The husbands would go to work, and the wives would sit at home together, put the kids in one playpen, and they'd knit. And they created sewing circles. They'd knit. They'd talk about which butcher had the best cut of meat, which baker had the best bread. That died in the 70s and 80s when both parents started working. Well, the sewing circle is back now in terms of Facebook or in the form of social. And
Or in your town, Yelp, right? I mean, there's a case right now where New York is really cracking down these reviews by other people. This third party verification that you talk about is so important. In fact, it's at the level where the state of New York is going to restaurant owners and saying, if you create fake reviews, we're going to prosecute you.
It's funny you mention that because I'm actually not a fan of Yelp. I believe that Yelp is actually going to go away because of the social net that we have. If I'm getting a review in a restaurant from someone I don't know, why would I trust it? But if I'm getting a review from someone I've been friends with for 20 years and see it online, I'm much more likely to trust it.
That's a good point.
The concept of reviewing and people you trust, you know, I'm always drawn back to the quote from Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs where he said, "We covet what we know." You know, if I want to know of a restaurant in Peru, so I'm going to find someone in my network, a friend or a friend of a friend who I trust based on association, and that's going to be a good or bad thing. So that's going to tell me what airline to travel, what insurance company to use, what cell phone carrier to work with, because this information is now public. And
boy, there just aren't
starting to realize that.
Yeah, there just aren't many people who quote Hannibal Lecter for
although you've got another one in your book. Wasn't there a CEO that told his wife he wanted to know the taste of flesh? What isn't that in your book?
Yeah. I'm totally spacing on which one that was now, but it was one of the bad CEOs. He didn't go to he blew off both his parents' funerals as well. So, you know, there really comes a point where you're like, dude, maybe you just shouldn't really be interacting with people that much.
I think actually it's one of the guys I wanted to ask you about. I think it was quote to Al Dunlap. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, it was Chainsaw Al, right.
Chainsaw Al, and here's my question for you. So I work in the investment field, and Al Dunlap was the CEO of Scott Paper, which was going through very, very difficult times. Al comes in, turns the company around, sells it for a huge profit to Kimberly Clark. He was, and as you point out in your book, a hero of Wall Street. He goes to Sunbeam and fails miserably. What was different between those two companies that allowed him to succeed in one case but not in the other?
You know, it was interesting. People who talk to me most about the book in the negative say, oh, well, you know, look at all these instances where they succeeded. They never bring up the Sunbeam story. Because my belief is that you can go in with a chainsaw, okay, and you can cut down 100 trees to make room in the forest. But the problem is eventually you're going to run out of trees. And when you run out of trees, you're not going to have the seeds to replant. And you're going to run out of oxygen. You know, he went in and he made all these cuts and he just basically killed Scott Paper to rebuild it. That works on occasion. That's not going to work every single time. And in the end, the more flies with honey than vinegar rule really does apply.
Let's talk about when another regional company that a lot of people here are familiar with, if they go to Las Vegas, Zappos. I don't know if you drive on I-15. I think Zappos has adopted every inch of
Nevada. Yeah, they pretty much own every highway, right?
Of Nevada. Every inch is picked up by Zappos people, and they bought the old city hall and made a gonzo headquarters building there. What's that's an internet startup. What's Zappos doing right that got your attention?
Yeah, Tony's a friend of mine, and I love Tony's story because Tony's concept was very simple. He's like, shoes are not that sexy. You know, the shoes that you wear are sexy, but buying shoes, not so much. But he had this concept that internet sales, buying things online was going to be huge, but the differentiating factor needed to be service. So he didn't build a culture of shoes. He built a culture of service. You know, and his promise on every Zappos thing is delivering happiness. The concept that you will get your shoes, you will probably be upgraded to free shipping, you will love them, or you can return them for a full refund. And he stuck to that since day one. And everyone who used Zappos because someone else recommended it. That's how they got, I think, their first 10 million customers or something like that, was listening to everyone implementing changes that they asked them. You could call Zappos at 3 in the morning and say, you know, my shoes, after 100 miles, they broke. Oh, send them back. You know, and they were huge with customer service, and it really set them apart from everyone else. Because think about it, Zappos, what the hell does the name even mean? It's a Spanish derivation of Zapatos. It doesn't even have a great name. It was all customer service.
You know, I can see why you and Tony Hsieh would get along well. I've heard him speak on several occasions, and he gives the audience his cell phone, says, if you're ever in Las Vegas, give me a call. I'd love to meet with you. So
yeah,
he has
I mean, the first time I was in Vegas after I met him by email, someone introduced us, and sure enough, he's like, hey, if you're ever in Vegas, call this number. And I called the number, and he answered. And I'm like, hi, I'm looking for Tony. Hey, this is Tony. Yeah, Tony told me to call. No, this is Tony. You know? And I was shocked. And he brought me down to Zappos. He said, I'll send a car for you. You know, he believes in that mentality. And again, it's the same, you know, I've never seen the value in being a not nice guy. But there's tremendous value in being a nice guy.
And I agree with you. Where I was going with this is Tony sold his company to Amazon, which I think mm-hmm. a lot of people have great respect for. I do. I'm a huge fan of Amazon's. But you've got a story that surprised me in your book about their warehouses and the temperatures in the warehouses. How does a great company like Amazon, first off, tell our audience just briefly the story, and then how does a great company like Amazon allow that to happen?
Yeah, the interesting thing about Amazon had a bunch of warehouses where the temperatures were just off, and we were talking like 90s, or it was way too hot or way too cold. And when I say way too hot or way too cold, not the, oh, well, I'll put on a sweater, but like enough where like people were, you know, dropping and having like, heat stroke and things like that. The problem with things like that, when you have a great company, the greater your company, the bigger you'll get. But the bigger you get, the more you have to listen. The more you have to put your ear to the ground every single day and listen, because when it's just you and two other people in a garage, you know the temperature of the company, no pun intended. When, you know, you're opening up a call center and a warehouse each day, every single day you're opening up a new one, you have to make sure that your 360-degree listening skills are finely, finely tuned. And as soon as that came back and people were aware of that, they, you know, this won't stand, and they fixed the problems. And Amazon is still a very, very well-respected company and very well-run. I have a 4-month-old child at home, my first child, and Amazon Prime has taken on a life-altering meaning to me.
It's a lot tougher to get on shop.
Oh, my God. You know, so let alone, okay, we only have 8 diapers left, well, Amazon Prime will have another 1,000 here tomorrow. It's that concept of you know, trust, and that concept of confidence that comes with companies you trust. You know, people look at companies as inanimate objects, but they're actually very, very fluid, and they do have the ability to change for the better or for the worse. It's up to the CEO to lead that ship in the right direction.
Well, Peter, those are good words of advice. Our guest this morning is Peter Shankman. He's the author of Nice Companies Finish First. I certainly hope that ends up being the case. Peter, we apologize. In your book, you've got 9 traits of great leaders. We got to talk about 2 or 3 of them. But for those of you listening, you'll have to buy the book to get the others that we didn't cover. Again, it's Peter Shankman, and the book is Nice Companies Finish First. Peter, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Good stuff, and a nicer, better, fresher approach to dealing with people, and let's hope more do. So we said it'll be 61 and sunny today, mostly clear tonight, around 40. It's always good advice this time of year to cover your tomatoes if you still have them. Going to be 71 and breezy tomorrow. And then by Wednesday, rain likely, 70% chance. And that rain continues through at least Friday. So this is Mountain Money on KPCW. Only in Park City, only on KPCW, and we will be back to continue Mountain Money to talk about olive oil and the Goldman Sachs Small Business Program after this.
Underwriting on KPCW is supported by Mountain West Bank in Park City, a community bank offering home financing service and guidance. Mountain West Bank is located near Kearns Boulevard next to the movie theater. More information at mountainwestbank.com. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Hey, Dave, when is the best time for a story?
Sunday mornings at 8:30.
Hi, this is Kathy.
And I'm Dave. We're co-hosts of The Story Mine. Tune in Sunday mornings right here at KPCW.
Experience the treasures of storytelling every Sunday morning at 8:30.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We just finished talking with Peter Shankman, author of Nice Companies Finish First. I certainly hope that's the case, and Peter was certainly a very nice gentleman to chat with. I enjoyed speaking with him.
Yeah, interesting, interesting subject. Yeah.
And in studio now, we have Jessica McClurley. She is the owner of Moundtown Olive Oil here on Main Street and also at the Gateway. Larry and I were talking at the top of the hour about, I think we both had the first impression when we first saw that your sign come up and when you came into town, which is this a big enough space for a business to succeed? Clearly it is, so congratulations on that and welcome to Mound Money.
Well, thank you so much for having me on today.
How did you get the idea to open a store that specializes in olive oil and vinegars?
Well, you know, in the last several years, olive oil's profile has definitely been rising in terms of its health benefits, the way it assists in making food taste better, and olive oil bars are springing up all over the country. And Park City is definitely one of those places where people appreciate good food and good ingredients.
I've never heard it described as that, an olive oil bar. So you can sample oils?
Sample olive oils and balsamic vinegars, and a lot of times what we do is mix and match different vinegars and oils together so people find their favorite flavor combination.
You know, I was at a friend's house Saturday. They invited us over for dinner, and they had some great balsamic vinegar probably purchased at your store on Main Street. And one of the things I shared with them as I've gotten older, one of the secrets to cooking is a little bit of balsamic vinegar can fix almost any meal that may have gone a little sideways.
It's so true. It's the magic ingredient.
Not that that would ever happen to you.
You'd be surprised how often that happens to me. We put balsamic vinegar in a lot of things.
I put it on almost everything, and it does make it taste better pretty much 99% of the time.
Well, we want to talk more about olive oil because I just started becoming a huge fan of it a couple of years ago. I think, you know, part of the trend, you know, it's like olive oil, what's that, and why would I want it? And now I'm hooked on it. But let's talk about the Goldman Sachs Small Business Program.
Yes.
There's quite a competition to get accepted in their class. And is it a class where you meet in person and go to Salt Lake to Goldman Sachs headquarters? I think a lot of people don't know that Salt Lake is the second largest concentration of Goldman Sachs employees.
Huge. It's 1,800, I think,
yeah,
employees.
Yeah, and so there's a Goldman Sachs campus in the Valley. So
it's actually in part partnered with the Salt Lake Community College.
Okay.
And so classes are held at one of the campuses in Salt Lake, and we have teachers from Babson College, which is located back east, and they specialize in entrepreneurship. They've constructed this fantastic curriculum that really helps small business owners identify ways to grow their business. The ultimate goal is to grow your business, grow your revenues, and grow your employee base.
And so the folks from Babson College, do they come out to Salt Lake City and stay here for the duration of the program, or are you doing it via video conference? How does that work?
They have specialized instructors for each segment of classes. So we just finished a segment on financial statements. And so we had, you know, the financial statement guru come out for, you know, he was with us for 2 weeks.
In person.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And really, you know, walked all of the students through the intricacies of understanding financial statements and accounting. Because a lot of these small business owners, like myself, we specialize in our business. We don't specialize in accounting or human resources,
sure,
or marketing. So what they're trying to do is teach us all of those skills in a very concentrated format so that we can grow our business effectively.
And how many people are in your class?
Right now we have 34 students.
So that's a big investment by Goldman Sachs. I mean, it's costly to fly people out here to give those talks. What is the financial commitment on your end to be in the class?
None. My time.
That's great.
And Goldman Sachs is doing this across the country. They have these classes in major cities around the country, and Salt Lake has had 2 classes now, and it's, I think, a really valuable program for small business owners, especially in Salt Lake and Park City.
So what did it take to get in the class? I would imagine there were more than 34 business people who wanted in.
I don't know the exact number, but it reminded me of applying to college. I had about a 10-page application, a couple paragraph essays, resumes, financial statements, a lot of business background and interview. There was quite a bit of information that they required.
And what about your time commitment? How is do you meet a couple times a week, or what would you tell people that might be interested in the next class if Goldman Sachs has it? What should they budget time-wise?
There's about one class every other week, but it's 9 hours, so it's a full day out of your week. Mm-hmm. There's classwork on the side that you have to do, again, like college. Last week, I had to read 75 pages of financial analysis to really understand the financial statements. Did not keep me up at night.
So it's too early for you to see results, but can you see that you're going to see results?
Absolutely.
Down the road?
Absolutely. It's such a valuable networking tool too, because as a small business owner, you know, you're kind of by yourself. You don't have coworkers. And so to have 34 people who are in the same position as I am right now to bounce ideas off of or to interact with about human resources questions, things like that, it's already been an invaluable experience.
So what are some lessons you've learned either, you know, organizationally or for running your – how do you look at your business different having been in the program for a couple weeks now?
One of the things that I've taken away is that I have to run my business and not work in my business. As a business owner, you want to be involved in every aspect, but right. That takes you away from the overall goal of growing your business because you're involved in the day to day.
It's hard. My parents ran their own small business, and you know, somebody doesn't show up, guess who's working that night?
That happened to me last Saturday night.
It happened a lot.
Somebody had a fever, and I worked. So it happens quite a bit, but it's a good reminder all the time to kind of take a step back and say, what do I want to do here? I want to grow my business. I don't want to, you know, be involved in sweeping the floors.
And how do you want to grow your business? It seems if you have I've seen your storefront. It's not a large space, but it sells balsamic vinegar and olive oil. How would you grow it?
Right.
By having one in every mountain town or what?
In a perfect world. Ideally, I'd like to open up a couple more locations in the Salt Lake Valley or wherever I'd identify ideal places to go. And I'd also like to grow my internet business as well.
Now, did you have any business plan? How did you start when you had an idea and said, I want to have a shop specializing in this? Did you start with a business plan and go to a bank, or did you just, is it the old classic got out the credit cards for cash advances kind of thing?
Pretty much bootstrapped it, you know, got it going on my own, and thankfully got it started, you know, right at the time, 2009, when banks weren't lending money. So I was able to self-finance, and so far so good.
Was this a model that you saw somewhere else and said, I think this would work in Park City?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And at the time when I started, there wasn't Main Street had a ton of vacancies, a lot of beautiful art galleries, but not sure. A lot of really great interactive shopping experiences. So for visitors coming here every year, it's been a lot of fun for them to come with their families, taste new things, experience new flavors.
It is a fun store to go to. So is your store a franchise, or did you see the idea somewhere else and say, I can do this without franchising?
Exactly. It's independently owned.
Okay.
And I would imagine on Main Street, people want to shop. That's part of the vacation is shopping, and they don't want to haul home big stuff, but a bottle of olive oil for $10 or $20, they can.
Well, the airlines are kind of cracking down on the liquids. Have you found that to be an issue? Are most of the purchases from tourists, do you end up shipping it directly to their house?
Yeah, we do a lot of shipping. And a lot of times people will put it in their suitcase, you know, check their bag. I've had a lot of people tell me they put it in their ski boots when they check it through.
Okay.
Always hoping that nothing breaks. But boy, yeah, we do a lot of shipping.
Broken olive oil in a suitcase.
In your ski boots.
Could be
in your ski boot, no less.
Could be
trying to throw
ugly.
Some business to some of the ski shops too. So.
Well, let's talk more about olive oil. Does all olive oil come from Italy?
No. Actually, some of the best olive oil in the world right now is coming from the Southern Hemisphere in Australia and Chile.
Really?
Yeah. The most important thing to know about olive oil is that you want really fresh olive oil. It's pressed twice a year, once in the Northern Hemisphere, once in the Southern Hemisphere. And what you see at the grocery stores a lot of times is adulterated oils that have been watered down with safflower oil or canola oil. So even though the label says it's extra virgin, 9 times out of 10, it's not.
Really?
And that's where you get the health benefits, is when it's truly extra virgin olive oil. You get all the great antioxidants that help prevent heart disease.
Well, what does extra virgin mean? Does that just the first squeeze?
Yes, the first squeeze at a cold temperature, so below 90 degrees. And
that's the healthy olive oil.
That's the healthy stuff. That's the magic elixir that doctors say has been proven to prevent heart disease and stroke by 30%.
It's also great to cook with. It's much easier to cook with than like a vegetable oil.
Yeah, and once you start heating up oil, there's a chemical reaction that causes...
Smokes the house, but olive oil doesn't.
Olive oil is fantastic. I would cook with it every day.
Yeah. Well, and vegetable oil is the polar opposite. It's flat out unhealthy, isn't it?
Well, it's a saturated fat. And olive oil is the kind of fat that, you know, your doctors want you to have in your diet, the really good healthy fats.
Right, right. And more important to me, it's very forgiving. As you know, Larry, my wife travels a lot, so I do a fair amount of cooking at the house. And it's much easier for me to succeed with olive oil and balsamic vinegar. So let me ask you some balsamic vinegar questions.
Okay.
First off, that's a weird name. What does balsamic mean?
It's a style. It's a condiment from Italy. All balsamic vinegars have to come from Modena. In Italy. So like champagne has to come from Champagne in France. Okay. Everywhere else it's just sparkling wine.
In a good bottle of balsamic vinegar, we've actually had this discussion at the Wells household. You know, we have to budget for the bottle. Doug's spending a little too much on balsamic. A good bottle of balsamic vinegar goes for about the same price as a good bottle of wine. Is the process that they make the vinegar? I know vinegar processing and winemaking are very similar.
They are similar. They come from grapes. And in the wine process, the sugars of the grapes turn into alcohol. And in vinegar, the sugars condense and become really thick and create this dense ball of sugars that then get watered down with more grape juice. And it just becomes sugary vinegar. There's no
instead
added
of the sugar going to – they don't put the yeast in so it doesn't become
exactly.
alcohol.
Exactly. There's none of that fermentation process.
Okay.
And they go from a large barrel when it's first pressed down to very small barrels over the course of 10 to 12 to 20 years. Some of the best vinegars in the world are 50 years old.
I was going to ask. You said the secret to good olive oil is fresh olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
What's the secret to good balsamic vinegar? Clearly it's not freshness because it's 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, the aging process for sure.
Okay.
Aged in the true Modena style. A lot of times you'll see at the grocery store balsamic style vinegar, which is usually just a white vinegar that has some sugar added and some food coloring. It's not the real deal.
Oh, don't tell me that.
That's why you need to shop at my store.
There you go.
Okay, and the store is where?
It's at 613 Main Street. Right above Mary Jane's. We also have a store at the Gateway down in Salt Lake.
And have you tried marketing online?
Yes, we have a really active website, mountaintownoliveoil.com, and all of our products are available online.
Okay, very good. Well, thanks for joining us. Jessica McCleary, owner of Mountain Town Olive Oil and one of the participants in Goldman Sachs' small business program.
Very good. And our next guest coming up is going to be Norm Nelson of Vivint.com. Jessica, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me today.
You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment.
Tune in to KPCW every Tuesday morning at 9 to hear This Green Earth.
We'll cover environmental issues from local to global, from snowpack to giant squid,
geothermal energy to gray wolves,
and honeybees to sustainable chocolate. Brought to you by Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough,
Republic Services,
Habitat for Humanity's Restore,
and Rocky Mountain Power.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We just had Jessica McClearly in the studio, owner of Mountain Town Olive Oil. There's all these small businesses, Larry, that you wouldn't think could be built into a nice little business, but there's a great example of one doing just that.
Exactly, and I guess she really does business anywhere because you said she has an active
website. Via the
internet,
yeah. Exactly. And our current guest is with Vivint, Norm Nelson. And Vivint, for folks that don't know, is one of the largest home security companies in the United States, and they are based here, right here in Utah. They had a huge successful sale last November when they sold for $2 billion to Blackstone. So there's another business
Holy
that you think
cow.
Of being a small mom and pop.
That's yet, a lot of olive oil.
that's a real business right there. Norm, thanks for coming in and joining us. Can you tell our audience what do you do with Vivint?
Yeah, first, thanks for having me. This is exciting. I'm happy to be here. I'm the director of Vivint's Central Station. And for those of you that aren't in the industry, what that means is my team handles all of the alarms. So if you have a home alarm system, your alarm goes off, whether it be a medical alarm, a burglary alarm, a fire alarm, it's my team that responds to those alarms. We'll call your house, make sure you're okay. If you're not okay, if we can't get a hold of you, we'll dispatch the authorities to protect you and your family.
And is that center based here in Utah as well?
We do. We have one here. And for redundancy purposes, we actually have a second station. So we're sister stations in St. Paul, Minnesota. And that station was actually the first central station that Vivint acquired a few years ago, and then we built the one in Provo.
So that means if your burglar alarm goes off in Sacramento,
mm-hmm.
you hear about it here.
It's actually not location-based.
Oh, okay.
It's wherever we're going to be the fastest. So I live here in Utah. When my alarm's gone off, the few false alarms we've had, every time it's gone to a rep in Minnesota. Not because Utah wasn't closer, but because Minnesota's going to be faster for me as a Vivint customer. So every signal that comes in, every alarm that comes in, simply goes to whichever station can handle it the fastest.
So you run. Can I use the term call center?
Sure.
Is that fair? Mm-hmm. And call centers are known for having fairly high turnover.
Yes.
Right? It's a tough position to keep people happy in that role. And we just had Peter Shankman in talking about the importance of culture and having a productive culture, a positive culture. What sorts of things does Vivint do to help make it an enjoyable job for your employees?
That's a great question. There's a lot of things that I think Vivint does right and does really, really well. One of those things is focusing on the employee. Our CEO and founder, Todd Peterson, has a saying, when people ask him, why is Vivint so successful? What have you done? What's been your secret? He'll often say, my father told me when I was starting this business that if you treat the people that work for you like gold, everything else will fall into place. So the sales and the profitability, everything else will follow. And so as part of that, some of the things Vivint does, we offer a very flexible work schedule. We employ, especially here in Provo, a lot of college students, and that's very important to them. We offer a free lunch every day. So we have a cafeteria in-house. We have a catering company that provides – and these aren't like, you know, cruddy meals. These are really nice.
Aren't prepackaged yesterday's egg salad.
No, not at all. It's a really nice company. There's a really nice job. So for lunch one day, you might have steak, and the next day might be a nice, you know, really nice chicken. It's very well done. It's something I know the employees appreciate. I appreciate. I enjoy it. There's a lot of other benefits and perks. You know, we're a summer sales-driven company, so we just finished our summer sales season. And so we're having our year-end party in the beginning of October. And that'll be – it's free to every employee. They're bringing in Imagine Dragons, which is a well-known band. We're renting out the Energy Solutions Arena. It's going to be this awesome thing, all for the employees. And it's something that Todd really believes in, and something I enjoy seeing that we do as well.
You know, talk about the beginnings of this company, because I, you know, and maybe I was just not paying attention or had not been marketed to or whatever, but I think one of the first times I heard about it was when it was sold for billions of dollars. So how did this company start, and did it acquire to grow, or did it all grow organically out of Provo, Utah?
Yeah, it's all organic growth. So Todd started as a BYU student, decided he wasn't learning what he wanted to learn in school, so he dropped out of BYU and started this business. It actually started out as a pest control company, selling pest control door-to-door during the summer.
Well, that's an odd transition.
Yeah.
It sounds odd, but it's actually very common. Those, because of the sales component,
exactly.
They've got very similar sales components.
That's right. The summer sales model where you go door-to-door. So they had a couple of salesmen that wanted to go try out home security. They tried it out, and the first guys that tried it out, it didn't go so well. So they came back to Todd and said, we like our job back selling pest control. But Todd and his team said, you know, maybe there's something to this home security aspect. So they invested in it a lot more, sent out more salespeople, and it really took off. And at that time, they were selling their accounts. So they'd send out salespeople to knock door to door all over the country, and they'd sell a bunch of accounts in the summer, way more than most companies would sell in an entire year. And they'd turn around and sell those accounts to some of the larger players in the security market. So and back then it was known as Apex Alarm. So Apex didn't have anything to do with the customer after the sale. They'd sell the account, a couple weeks later sell the account to an ADT or a Monitronics or somebody like that. And those companies then owned the customer service portion of it. They owned everything relating to the customer, the contract.
So, Norm, let me pause you there because I think this is an important point. Larry, you and I have talked to different entrepreneurs about the importance of pivoting and looking at your business model and tweaking it. So here's a couple really big tweaks, right? First, pest control into home alarms, then home alarms, selling it to somebody else, probably maybe getting like $300 each time that you sold it to ADT or one of the big players. In the press release we've got that you guys have 675,000 customers. And the company, Larry, sold for $2 billion, right? So the value per customer is like $3,000 per customer is what Blackstone paid for Vivint. That's a really important decision that put Vivint on a different trajectory to say we're going to service this in-house, but it costs a lot of money to do that, right?
It does, and that's a key pivot point in the company is Todd saw that when we were selling our accounts to other companies, the customer service aspect was terrible. He likes to say it was literally a joke. So they decided to keep everything in-house. So they built a customer service organization. They built the call centers, the technical support centers.
It's a gutsy move.
Absolutely. It's a huge investment. It's very expensive. Yeah. Then they acquired the central station in St. Paul, Minnesota, and off of that brought some people over to Utah and built the central station here, which is also expensive. But by owning that customer experience, by owning those teams and keeping them in-house, Vivint's been able to create a culture that we want. And part of what we believe, or what I believe, is customer service is the way you treat your employees translates into how they treat their customer. If they're having a lousy day, they don't think they're valued by the company, their manager doesn't care about them, they're not really going to pass that on to the customer in a good way. It's going to come across as, my boss doesn't care about me, I don't really care about you or your problem.
But if you just had steak for lunch, you're feeling pretty good about the company.
Hopefully that helps. And that's certainly not the end-all be-all. I mean, the free lunch is nice, but there's a lot more that goes into making an employee feel valued than giving him a free lunch. But that's where I think Vivint's success has come from, is we like to control our own destiny. So we build we now, after the Blackstone acquisition, everything's in-house. We have our own electrical engineers to build our own hardware, our own equipment, our own panels, again, to differentiate ourselves and have complete control over the customer experience.
So, Norm, we're a small town here, and you'd be surprised the type of topics that make headlines, front page headlines here. You know, typically, sometimes dogs, the debate over dogs will make front page headlines. And a couple
doesn't
months ago,
doesn't get any bigger than that. It really doesn't.
A couple of months ago, what was making headline news, actually at the start of the summer, was the cost of the local police department to responding to false alarms. What is Vivint doing, and how do you guys handle that and do what you can to reduce the number of false alarms?
That's a fantastic question, and that falls directly into my area of responsibility. It's one of the metrics I report on to my VP every single week is how many alarms have you dispatched on and how many of those were actual emergencies. It's very important to us for our relationship with our customers and with the what we call the authorities having jurisdiction, so whether it's the sheriff or the police or whoever it may be, that we're doing a good job, we're doing it the right way. So we've made some changes at the beginning of this year where we make an extra phone call, for one thing, before we dispatch. So we used to just make one phone call. Your alarm went off, we'd call your house. If we didn't get an answer, we'd call the police. And now we'll make two phone calls. We'll call your house, and often when we're calling your house, we're actually going over the panel. Our panels all have a cell unit built into it, so we can do a two-way voice connection without actually having to call your phone. And that's important for like a medical emergency. If somebody's hurt and can't get to the phone, we can still talk to them and hear them. So if we can't get you over the panel, we'll now try your cell phone and find, you're in the backyard and your dog ran in the house or whatever set off the alarm. That's helped quite a bit. That's reduced our dispatch rate significantly. Some of the other things we do is we customize, or we have the ability to customize for every single customer how they want us to handle their alarms. So, Doug, if you have a special situation at home, you're having guests staying with you for the next couple of weeks, and you want to make sure we're not handling that the wrong way, you can call us. We'll put some temporary notes on your account and adjust it so that we're handling it specific to your home and to your needs.
So you're monitoring a house for fire, for water.
We can.
For a flood, broken pipe or something, and for burglary. Now, do you have your own cars that respond, or do you send everything straight to the police or fire?
It depends on the town in most cases. When we can, we like to work with the city authorities, so the police department, the fire department, the ambulance. In some cities and towns, they don't want us to use their police because they feel it's an excessive cost. In those places, we have a guard response company that we contract with, and we'll send out a guard response first. If it's a burglary alarm for medical, we'll still go to ambulance. We do work a lot with those authorities to try and understand what their needs are. And a lot of times, you know, we try to educate our customers as well, because the vast majority of our alarms are false alarms, as with any security company, and the vast majority of those are user error. People maybe not being completely familiar with or comfortable with their alarm system. So education on our part is a big piece.
So let me ask an impolite question, which is, why do you need an alarm if most every time it's going to go off, it's going to be an inconvenience and false? And
yeah, no, that's a good
question.
Have
you apologizing?
That's a fair question. And I hope nobody feels like they apologize. We get that a lot when we get a false alarm. We'll call somebody's home and say, "Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, please don't be mad at us." And our response is, "Heavens, no. That's why we're here, is to take care of you." So we're now over 800,000 customers after another successful summer sales season. And we're getting about, 60,000 alarms a week, right now. And those are the high priority alarms, the medical alarms, the fire alarms, burglary alarms. And out of those, we're going to see several hundred actual emergencies every single week that my team will deal with. So we know that there are people out there whose lives we are affecting in a positive way. Hopefully we're helping them in their time of need, saving lives. There's stories that we can share about people whose life was saved because of an alarm system. So I would say alarm system really does make a difference. It can help. That's why homeowners insurance companies give you a discount if you have an alarm system. Even though the vast majority of alarms are false, there are still the real alarms that come through. And I think if we did a better job and customers did a better job using their alarms, understanding it, and we did a better job educating them on how to use it, you'd see that false alarm rate go down. But you're still going to see the number of actual emergencies are going to remain the same.
Okay. Interesting. Well, the company is Vivint, and so mostly it's door-to-door sales in the summertime.
That's the majority of it. We do sales all year round, of course. We have a sales team. We're nationwide. We're also in Canada, Puerto Rico, and we just opened an office internationally. Mostly door-to-door driven, but we have a sales presence all year round.
That's that. I'm sure you love when people sign up via the internet as well. And I see here in my notes, people can get a hold of Vivint at vivint.com, V-I-V-E-N-T.
It's actually V-I-V-I-N-T, sorry.
Oh, my notes are wrong. My mistake. Our guest, Norm Nelson, he runs the call center for Vivint here in town. And as we said, very substantial business, just sold for $2 billion last year. Norm, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thanks, Norm. And we will be back to wrap up Mountain Money after this.
Park City Realty Group is proud to support KPCW. Park City Realty Group has provided real estate services to buyers and sellers since 2005. Our team shares local knowledge and insight with clients who value the Park City lifestyle. Knowledge plus hard work equals success. 649-1991 or parkcityrealtygroup.com.
This is Christian Bohr with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Did you know that by shopping locally, you're supporting trail maintenance, our free bus system, and the many wonderful cultural and recreational opportunities in our community? When you shop or dine in Summit County, those dollars stay right here in Summit County. The Park City Chamber Bureau is pleased to support KPCW's locally grown radio show, Mountain Money. Remember, keep it local, keep it PC. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
And welcome back to the final minutes of Mountain Money and three interesting guests. And I was interested, Doug, in Peter Shankman's book, Nice Companies Finish First. And one of the other people he profiled is Yvon Chouinard, who was a climbing bum at Yosemite.
Patagonia.
And founded Patagonia. And I actually wound up at a dinner where he was at our table, and I hadn't been introduced. I didn't know who he was until I figured it out when somebody addressed him as Yvon, and I figured
there's not a whole lot.
There aren't a lot of Yvons. Yeah. I bet this is the Patagonia guy. And he said, yeah, he picked his location for Patagonia, Ventura, California, because it had the best surf break in Southern California.
Yep. I can see that. And, we live here in Park. We all live here in Park City, or most of us live here in Park City for a reason, right? We want to live here. So if you're going to start a company, you might as well start it where you want to live.
Exactly. So we're coming up on 10 o'clock on NPR News. First, wanted to remind you, sunny 61 today, sunny and breezy tomorrow and 71, and then rain returns by Wednesday. So too bad for that. A little bit of employment news we can squeeze in real quick.
Yeah, Utah's doing quite well. The August numbers just came out, and Utah's unemployment rate is 4.7%, and that compares very favorably to the 7.3% we're seeing nationwide.
Wow. Yeah.
So we're doing a lot of things right in this state.
Indeed. Okay. Well, this has been Mountain Money in KPCW in Park City. And right now it's time for NPR.